All right, welcome to Friday, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for joining us here. Mike Jeffers, Chicago Jazz Magazine, ChicagoJazz.com. And of course, you are watching, listening, hearing, experiencing Chicago Music Revealed, episode 56. As you all know, I need to elongate that intro song because for some reason, you guys come on, you guys see me, and then the intro kicks in. So I'll adjust for next week when we get into next week. But thanks to Craig Pylo, as usual, for the incredible theme song that he put together for me. I really appreciate that. Hopefully everybody's doing well. Of course, I'm also the director of programming and entertainment at the soon-to-be-opening Epiphany Center for the Arts right there, 201 South Ashland Avenue. We got some encouraging news about restaurants and bars opening up June 26th, indoor and outdoor. That happened today that the mayor announced it. So June 26th is when that's able to happen. And next step, hopefully, is going to be possibly some live music. And I know we're planning an entire series starting, kicking off in September. They didn't mention anything about live music venues, although they are saying that 50 and less. So that's going to probably hurt some live music venues to be able to open, but at least somebody will be able to open. So I digress. All the information about Epiphany Center for the Arts is epiphanyshy.com. All right, now, today, of course, it's Friday, and what does Friday mean? Friday means Chicago Blues and Beyond with Dave Katzman. He's going to be on in 1 second, and we are going to bring on, a legend of the Chicago blues scene, and I am excited and honored to have her on. Joanna Connor's coming on, and Dave Katzman, there they are. How are you guys? Well, I'll tell you what, I when Dave told me that you were going to come on, man, I've been a fan for a long time, and I've seen you, I know you've been there, but usually it's like at Kingston Nines at like, you know, midnight, and you know, who cares about anything at that point other than just listening to music. So, you know, before we get into it, I mean, I know that you are used to playing like 7 nights a week. You're constantly touring. You're constantly playing, especially during this time of the year, you're constantly touring. So how are you coping with this COVID-19 situation? And after 3 months, I mean, how are things going?
And some of it came through, some of it didn't, but really it was a blast by a lot of fans and people I don't even know, sending money in because of live streams or just sending money. And I'm writing songs for people for Father's Day. I'm trying to think of new ways to generate income, you know. And this is the longest my entire performing life, which I started at 17 in clubs, so 41 years. This is the longest I've been without playing.
Well, and also, I mean, this is you know, I've talked to a lot of musicians in the past couple of months, obviously on the show, and a lot more outside of this show. And I mean, this is the first time this has ever happened, ever, which is like, you know, when people say unprecedented. It's actually unprecedented. I mean, you know, it's not even like the financial crisis, like I always say, because in 2008, there was still clubs, there was still business, something was happening. Yeah. But this is like the worst industry to be in for a pandemic to happen where you can't be near people, you can't be close to people. And that's the entire situation. So, you know, I know that you've been doing some live streaming stuff and been doing some, because I've seen you on some of the live stream things and you're keeping busy that way and you're doing some teaching as well. I think you've got a student right after this show coming up. Is that how you're keeping everything kind of moving forward during this strange time?
Yeah, it is. I picked up a few. I did one show up in Barrington. I did a private show. Private shows with people at their house. I got one coming up in Evanston. So just stringing things together, you know.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I'm going to turn it over to Dave Katzman, our co-host of Chicago Blues and Beyond here on the Chicago Music Revealed show. And I know you've known Dave for many, many years.
Ever.
So I'm going to.
Yes. Decades.
At least a few. Quite a few.
Yeah, quite a few.
Yeah, Joe and I go back.
Take it from here, Dave. I want to hear two people that are on the blues scene talk about the blues for a little while. I'm going to get out of the way.
Okay. Well, you know, Joanna, like you just said, we've been here forever. There's people there listening to the show, I hope, and they don't know your history and how you came through. So we can kind of start there. You came to me in 1984. And with Buddy Guy and Junior Wells and James Cotton and people like that, Luther Allison, and what brought you here? And what was the impetus?
My mom was a big music lover. She was a pianist, but her parents were like, no, you can't do that, you know. She was born in like 1930, so she went to Purdue and studied biology, but in her heart, she was always a musician. So I heard blues and jazz and classical when I was born. So blues is nothing new to me, and I would follow Massachusetts, and my mother worked in a college, and in the 70s, a lot of the Chicago blues bands are coming through. And I would go and see them a lot. And when I turned 19, myself and another bandmate went on a street trip in a van and stopped. And we knew we wanted to go to Chicago. We came here, and it was actually during the Jazz Fest. And, you know, growing up in the East Coast, there's music, but the music scene here, I mean, it's just unparalleled, especially back then. And I mean, a free jazz festival. I mean, we went to the Newport Jazz Festival, we paid for it, you know. So that was my introduction. We were like, and then I ended up at the Kingston Mines, went to Blues, went to the Checkerboard. I mean, went to Teresa's, and I was like, well, this is heaven. You know, people, you know, Lonnie Brooks walking down the street, whatever, Coco Taylor. And I was like, I have to move here. And so a few years later, I had a kind of a distant cousin, and he kind of hooked me up with an apartment to rent, and I got a job. And yeah, the job, I think I worked a month, and I got my first gig. So, yeah.
What you got you into electric blues? Where, guitar-wise, how did you start?
I started on a classical guitar and then quit for years. I was a kid and picked up acoustic guitar and studied like some old ragtime and Delta and Piedmont blues and slide with the guy in my hometown, but that was acoustic. And then I was in my first band when I was 17. People were older than me. We did like a hybrid kind of, we played acoustic instruments with a drummer, but we did like bluegrass and blues and some country rock, different things. And then I ended up playing, my boyfriend at the time in the band got me a Telecaster. And I was like, I was 18. And he said like, here, that was my birthday present. So it was a great birthday present. But I was more of a singer. I wasn't really a guitarist per se. And I played sax for years, like growing up. I was in like city bands. And I studied that more than the guitar, actually.
Wow.
And then let me think about this. So I got my first blues gig through my guitar teacher, a harmonica player that knew him. And he just laid on, I had heard a lot of electric blues, but even like Howlin' Wolf to me and Jimmy Rogers and the Fabulous Thunderbirds were starting to really come on. And he studied this stuff, and I played rhythm guitar, and they loved the way I played rhythm guitar because, you know, I knew as a musician that was one of the things I always had was a really good sense of rhythm and feel. So even though I wasn't soloing at that point, I was a good rhythm guitarist. So, and then got a steady gig at a place called Ralph's Diner, which was really pretty famous in the 80s for it was kind of like the Kingston Mine, but it was a gig upstairs, a stage upstairs and downstairs, and upstairs was like a more of a punk room, and like people like Black Flag played there and
wow,
like heavy punk people, and we were downstairs doing the blues R&B thing. So yeah, so that's how that happened. And moved to Chicago, and yeah, that's the
easiest. Okay. Well, I know you played saxophone. That's interesting. Well, now I'm going to listen to your slide playing and try to hear it sax line. Tell us about Dion Payton's band.
Well, my mission when I moved to Chicago was I really wanted to focus on guitar, and I didn't really want to sing because that's what I was doing more. I was like the singer with the rhythm guitar. And I'm like, I got to crack this mystery of this guitar stuff. And I mean, the pentatonic scale and whatever, but I was just like, something's not clicking. I want to find a gig with the best guitar player I can. And I would go out every night of the week, and there were so many fabulous players, but I saw Dion, and he was actually in Lonnie Brooks' band. He was Lonnie's rhythm guitarist. And but he opened the show, and I was just a fan from the get-go. So I was always following him around, bothering him. And and Lonnie used to let me sit in. And eventually, a few months later, it was January of 85. I was actually sitting in the Kingston Mines. And he came up to me and he said, "Hey, I'm going to start my own band and I'd like you to be in it." And I was like, yeah, wow. I was thrilled. So, yeah. We started the house band at the Checkerboard Lounge on the weekends. So that was my, those were my magical days. But,
the house band at Checker was quite a session. Absolutely. Absolutely back then. Your slide playing, I try to put this, but it's a little bit on the hair side.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Dion came out of a kind of heavy bag in many ways.
Yeah.
And it was at a time blues were going that route.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a lot of, you know, young white players doing it. A lot of the English guys doing heavy blues. But actual Chicago blues players playing heavy wasn't really happening.
Right.
And, it's interesting to see the progression you're doing now. And the fact that you played at Kingston Mines for so long for a younger crowd, it's kind of like the bridge to the youngest to blues. Mm-hmm. I came into blues. I heard Muddy Waters, but I also heard Eric Clapton and, you know, Jeff.
Sure. Burr,
you know, at the same time, and you know, I could see the direct lineage, but a lot of people, a lot of young people today, have no clue. You know, they think Steve.
Yeah.
Started the blues, you know. Stevie was great, and you know, it certainly would be totally respectful to Albert and Buddy and everybody else. But you know, what do you think of the younger crowd? What do you think of the younger crowd? And I mean, playing three nights a week at Kingston Mines, you certainly got a feel of it, you know.
Yeah, well, yeah, it always starts up kind of the older crowd. By 11, it's a young crowd. To be honest with you, they're my favorite crowd. I mean,
really?
They're. Yeah, with beyond a shadow of a doubt. They, there's been some kind of a kinship between myself and the younger, you know, millennials, I guess, and younger. My son's 33, and a lot of his friends were talking about me to him, not realizing I was his mother. And yeah, they've embraced me more than any other generation, even when I was that age playing for people my age. So. Something about me and what I do and how I present it, they've gravitated to. And, you know, they're open-minded about things. They bring a lot of energy when you're playing. So it's been a wonderful fit the last 10 years, I would say, for me. And it's one of the few places that has blues. I mean, I'll definitely play a little bit more rock, a little bit more soul when they're there, but there's always blues there. But they, you know, some of them are kind of knowledgeable because of their parents who are my age. You know, they're like, "Oh, my dad and my mom played this and that," or they took me to the Kingston Mines. So some of them do know, but some of them are just like their first blues band they've ever seen or blues rock band. And that's fine because it turns them on to other things. You know?
That's great. That's really good. And speaking of the millennials and their whole new way of looking at things.
Mm-hmm.
You had a video that was viewed 7.5 million times.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
How did that happen?
Yeah. It's the funniest story because I had had one before that that was me playing at a festival in Maine, and a guy just kind of like, I play walking blues, and there's this one section where I kind of go crazy, blah, 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 you know, just riffing. And it's like a showpiece thing. And the guy took that and put it out there. And he was the first one to call me. It was like 2013, 14. He's like, "Oh, Joanna, you know, you have 100,000 views in Russia." And I'm like, 100,000 views? And I never had more than 30,000. You know, that was the biggest video I ever had. And it was because it was a video about ganja. And it was a reggae song. So that was my most popular video. And that was like maybe 5,000-6,000 views, you know. And I didn't think much of it. I'm like, the internet, whatever. And then that video started going all over the world. I mean, it didn't get so big on YouTube, maybe like it's a million. I had like 8 million views in Brazil, 10 million views in Italy, 20 million. I mean, it was probably up to now 70 million views of that video. And I did interviews with newspapers in London and in Sweden. And it was pretty amazing. And I actually got a gig with a Russian guy, billionaire, who flew me to Spain for a private party from that video.
Wow.
So then this other party comes up, and it's the same song, but it's at a party in a friend of mine's backyard in Massachusetts, who always helps out the musicians. Like, need a gig, he can find you a gig, give you a place to stay. He's like, hey, could you do a little something in my backyard? And it's literally like 20 people in the backyard, tiny backyard. And he films it. And that one gets 7.5 million views. And I got a call from a movie production company, and we did a movie and Ben Affleck's in it, and it's gonna, well, we don't know when it's gonna be out because of what just happened. So like all this crazy stuff happened out of the blue from the internet, and I didn't put any of those videos up, you know.
That's amazing. So did that spark the interest of Intrepid, your agency?
Well, you know, I had worked with Booth back when he was with Steve Hecht, which was Piedmont Talent, because right. That's when I used to tour. And so Rick, he said I was the first gig he ever booked. He was fresh out of college. I forgot what it was. And it was actually during the Gulf War. And he goes, I remember all these gigs kept getting canceled. And so I talked to Rick a couple times. He's like, well, I have room on my roster. Da, da. And then he saw us play in Vegas last September. And he was thinking about it, but that we did a great job. And he's like, yeah, I want to sign you. And I've known you forever. I think this is your time, and you're building momentum. And yeah.
So, great.
Yeah, I was told I had a lot of festivals this year. And this would have been our first summer working with them. And yeah, the plague.
You know. The plague. Yes, indeed.
Well, I'm like intrigued about the videos and how you connected with all these different things. You must have had a ton of work out of having those videos going in Brazil and everywhere else. You must have been reached out to, right? I mean, but you didn't put any of those up. So what was the, you know, I mean, nobody asked you, hey, you know what? That's my video. I'm got this or that. Or they put it up and then you were able to just start booking things just like that.
Yeah. I don't know if I think the guy that put that went over the world, he said he didn't watermark it or something, so he couldn't claim anything. And I had somebody try to monetize it. I guess it's this, I don't know if I have the wrong people or what, but there's just the legality behind it is pretty difficult.
Yeah.
And this last one, I think the man that put it up might have made some money off of it, but you know, I'm like, whatever, I'm not gonna. I look at it as free. I always like the idea, like the Grateful Dead. They used to let everybody record their shows, and they became famous. And even way back in the day, when people wanted to like use tape recorders for me, I'm like, yeah, go ahead, because I knew that the Dead were really successful with that. And I'm like, yeah, let people, you know, what I think it's the best promotion, and you can't really, you know, you can't buy that kind of promotion.
No, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
It's very true.
So I want to jump in, Dave, real fast, too, because I want to follow up. I know you were in the house band at the Checkerboard, and I'm always, when I'm talking to, you know, musicians of, like, your stature who's done so much stuff and done so much playing and played with so many people, when you were coming up, I mean, the Checkerboard was still around. I know Dave and I talked a bit about this with the Branch, too, so I'm like a history buff, too, so I'd love to hear about some of these clubs. I mean, what was the scene like back then compared to now? It had to be completely different because everybody was out hanging a lot more, right? I mean,
yeah,
rather than now where, you know, everybody's either playing gigs or they just go home afterwards and stuff. I mean, talk a little bit about the scene and how important it was for your learning of the blues to be able to hang and talk to some of these legends so that you can actually pick their brains and become friends with them.
Yeah, I mean, it was a whole different culture. I mean, you know, nowadays people sit home and stream things, or, you know, they have huge high definition television 70 inches across. I mean, back then, yeah, there was cable, you know what I mean? There was screen TV eventually, but I mean, people went out for their entertainment, and I mean, clubs in general, in my opinion, were a lot more crowded. And I mean, any night of the week on Halstead, Blues and the Kiss of Mize were busy.
Yeah.
Every night of the week. And you know, the South Side scene was definitely different. I mean, it was the South Side, and it was more African-American people. But even there, I mean, most nights were, you know, there was the Cullin, there was Lee's Unleaded. There was several clubs, and some clubs I had never even been to. But, yeah, it was totally different. And, you know, I'd walk in the Checkerboard, and Buddy, it was like you walked in the door and then around the corner in front of the one window with the Budweiser sign or Old Style, whatever it was like Junior Wells, Buddy Guy, Lewis Myers, at other people sitting in around the table playing cards and smoking cigarettes and swearing and, you know, drinking. And it was like, I was standing there like, you know, I wish I had a cell phone back then.
Yeah.
And, you know, Lefty Diz and Johnny Dollar and B.B. Odom and Muddy Waters Jr. Like just all these people. And then I played with this guy named Max Simmons.
Yeah.
And we did some gigs on the West Side. And, you know, I'd walk in. I was young, totally innocent. Totally naive about certain things. And I played it. I think it was called, I cannot remember the name of the place. But I remember everything was white and gold. It was on the West Side. I walked in and people were looking at me. It wasn't a happy show. And then I played guitar with Mac. And, like, people were coming out to me, giving me money, giving me cocaine. Buying me drinks. I'm like, oh.
Well, I do want to say one thing about you, Joe. I saw you during those days. I saw you sit in with Junior and Buddy and all that. And you don't get to do that unless you can play. You know, and you being a woman into the circle. And, you know, they all thought the world of you. You know, they would be happy to have you on stage with them.
Yeah.
They always respected you as a young person coming up, but they also, mm-hmm. you know, in their own strange way, respected you as a woman, because there's not a lot of women that could cut it. And
especially then, there was nobody.
Definitely then, because it was very, as a young white guy, it was hard for me to get on with a lot of those guys.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I got my butt kicked quite a few times stage.
Yeah.
I'm sure you did too, but
the
vetting process in the blues, but you being a woman was an amazing thing. And I always appreciated that about you.
Thank you.
You know, first off, that they really took notice of you and then you held your own. I mean, it was great.
You had to. It was sink or swim. You know?
No kidding. Yeah. And I sank a couple nights.
Man, well, you know, they weren't going to be, it was no kid gloves. And
none.
Blunt and honest, even with me being a woman, you know, and playing with Aaron Burton. I mean, playing with Dion, they would yell and scream at me and about certain things. You're not doing this right. How do you not then, like, you know, whatever the
You're
situation
not doing
was.
Right. And then you ask them what's right and they go, learn it, you know, or whatever.
Yeah, so, yeah.
Yeah. I ain't telling you.
Yeah. I mean, Dion was probably the most helpful in the sense that, he literally, back, you know, when we first started, arranged everything. And he'd spoon-feed me rhythm parts. Like, you play this, do it like that, play this. And I had to do it, but it was the best training ever. And he was, like,
absolutely
impeccable about things. And he was, like, I would be playing, he'd be like, your E string's out of tune, or turn this down, or play your chord, don't hit that note. While he's playing, and tell me, I'll be like, you know, and then one of the things he taught me was, like, I used to open the show for him, but I couldn't play and sing. I used to do, like, the B.B. King thing, you know,
right.
Like stop. And he's like, you're opening the show and I'm not playing with you. I'm like, what do you mean? It was at the Mines because we had Thursday nights at the time. No, I do it. You better learn. And now pretty much I can play and sing anything at the same time. But at that, but he, like, drew me into the end of the pool, you know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. David Johnson still gives me a lesson every time I play with him.
Oh, yeah, Jimmy Johnson, he wasn't mince words at all. I remember one time I was playing with Big Time Sarah at the Blues. I was way in the beginning, and he walked up to Sarah and goes, why do you have her playing guitar? You could have hired me. You could have had a real guitar player. And I was just like,
what do you say to that?
I just stood there, like, poking my lip out, and now he comes up and he goes, I love the way you play guitar. And I thought, well, I guess I earned my respect with Jimmy, you know. But I mean, I was just beginning, so. But I know that one thing I had was I respected the music that was going on stage, and I know I had a good feel for music, and I knew I had enough soul for them to respect me. If I was stiff and whatever, I would have been like, oh boy, here we go. So, you know, but I learned, I was like a sponge, and that's exactly what I wanted, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, those lessons learned on stage are golden. You know, and I feel lucky to have had, you know, you know, it just, very few words, but a lot of knowledge. You know,
yes.
Was handed to you, and if you didn't get it, you'd heard about it.
Yeah.
But
and
you got it.
Yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
You got it. You got it from them.
Yeah.
You respected them, and they respected you too.
They did. Magic Slim was particularly sweet. Oh, Eddie Shaw. They were always encouraging to me. You know, Dion was a hard ass, but he was like my best teacher. He's like a hard, he was like Bobby Knight, you know, he was a, but it was a great musical experience for me.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, hey, so I'm watching the time, and I know you've got something coming up at the top of the hour here, so I want to be mindful of the time, but I wanted to touch base because we're going to send everybody over to joannaconnor.com. I've got the website up on the video right now, so everybody
can check that
out. What new releases should we be talking about? I think you just had one, Rise, with Mike Zito, I saw up on your website before we came live. Is that the most recent one?
Yeah. The most recent one. It came out in November, and it just came out on vinyl in April. Mike Zito is kind of a, you know, it's got some jazz on. It's got my band that I have now, and they're amazing.
Yeah.
It's got some blues. I think I have like the best band in anywhere, pretty much. And they really kick butt on this record. And then another amazing thing happened through a video is Joe Bonamassa noticed me on a video on Twitter and retweeted it and said some really nice things. And I messaged him saying, hey, if you ever want to get in touch with me, this is my stuff. Thank you. And we just made a record in February. So, and he played on it. He arranged it. And it's my first 100% real blues album. Like, it's nothing but blues. And Reese Winans from Stevie Ray's band plays keys, and Josh Smith and Joe Bonamassa playing rhythm guitar for me.
That's awesome.
Where'd you record that?
In Nashville at Ocean Way Studios.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's pretty amazing. And he's like, I know I'm a real hard ass. And I was like, Joe, I played in the Chicago blues scene. I don't think you know. Like, no, you're really okay. You're not a hard ass at all. He was a great producer. He really was. I really loved working with him.
When is that slated to come out? Do you even know? Because of the pandemic, probably everything got mixed around, right?
Yeah, it was supposed to be out right now, but he said January of 2021.
So that way you can hopefully tour with it next summer would be the ideal situation, right? Wow.
We're supposed to do a video with him.
Yeah. Oh, you're going to do a video with him? Nice.
Yeah. He wants to put his band behind me, like at Legends or somewhere in Chicago, and film it. And that'll be like the premiere for the record. And he's going to play guitar for me. I'm like, okay.
Did you tell him?
Okay, Joe.
did you tell him that you let him on your video because you probably have more likes than Joe does on your video?
Oh, so
you'll do him a favor.
That's a good one, Mike. That's a real good one.
He's actually, you know, I didn't really know like anything about him. I mean, he's a great guitar player.
Oh, yeah.
Sitting there next to him, like listening to him play, is like, holy crap. I mean, he can play any style of music you could imagine.
Great tone.
He really does know blues. I mean, he knows the insides and the outsides of everything. So the record that's coming out, people are probably thinking, oh, Joanna and Joan are going to make this rock blues record. It's going to be slick, but it's gut bucket, down home. Like, I play pedals straight through an amp with old stuff. So it's going to be interesting to see what people say, you know.
Well, can't wait.
So they should all head over to joannaconnor.com to get that information when that's going to get released. And, of course, pick up the new recording, Rise, with Mike Zito, now available on vinyl. Everything's over there. Dave, you want to take another question or two, and then we're going to wrap this up so she can get ready for her top of the hour sit down here that she's got coming.
The last question I had, you just asked. And I just want to say it's been great talking with you, Joe.
It went by fast.
Yeah, it did.
Well, we both appreciate you taking time, Joanna, and it's great to meet you virtually, and hopefully I'll get to actually meet you in person at a club when there's actual live music. What a concept that would be, huh?
Boy, can't wait. Well, thank you guys for having me and asking to be on this.
Oh, definitely. All right, thanks, Joanna. Good evening.
Bye, Dave.
All right, Joanna Connor. I'm gonna see if I know how to do this, Dave. I got it off there. Okay, deal. Let me bring
you.
I think I learned how to flip things around here on Skype. What a concept. That was a great interview, man. Thanks for getting her on here for Blues and Beyond here on Friday, man. That was It was good to catch up with her, and I don't think I've ever really heard her talk in depth about, you know, coming up on the blues scene and all of the different people. And I like the fact that you brought up that one point that, you know, she was like one of the only women that could cut it
Absolutely.
On the scene. And that's why they allowed her to actually come up on the scene and play with them, right?
Well, women, for the most part on the blues, especially back then, were just vocalists.
Yep, yep.
Rarely was there instrumentalists. And for people like Buddy Guy and Junior Wells and Magic Slim, I mean, these guys don't mess around, okay? And the fact that she earned their respect is really monumental. And I would always watch it and just so appreciate it. You know, she's got it. You know, she understands it and respects it, and they respect her, you know.
Yeah.
And it was good to see her coming up, and it's great to see what's happening right now with her. I mean, she deserves everything she's getting.
Yeah, no, 100%. And it's exciting to hear about the Joe Bonamassa connection there and the new recording and all that stuff that's going to come out January 2021. Breaking news here on Chicago Music Revealed, Blues and Beyond.
There you go.
So do we got anything else we need to cover? Usually Fridays, I think now the past couple Fridays with the guests, man, we've covered a lot of ground.
Right. Well, it's so easy to talk to these guys and gals, and they've got so much to say. But there is a cool thing happening on Father's Day out at Richie's Sport Lounge in Schiller Park. There's going to be an outdoor kind of blues festival jam. Joanna's going to be there. Omar Coleman, Rick King, Lindsay Alexander, Willie Buck, Brother John Catney, a whole bunch of other people.
Wow.
It's going to be a big barbecue, a blues jamboree. It starts at 2 o'clock. It's at 9812 West Lawrence, and I'm going to try to make it, you know, but we all got to stand a good distance from everybody, but, you know, I miss all my friends, and I really want to see them. It's been a long time, so that's basically what I've got for you today.
Well, that's a good thing to get. So I'm glad you put that out. And, you know, it's good to know that there's some live music starting to happen again, even if it's outside. And, you know, we're working towards, of course, as I always say, and as the people can see in the States, that got a little too loose with the social distancing. Everything
right.
started going backwards. So we need to stay on course. We need to keep socially distant. We need to have masks on everywhere we go so that these kind of events outside can turn into something inside, but everybody's got masks on and everybody's comfortable and everybody can stay safe. So we've got to keep the ball rolling, but it's encouraging to see musicians being able to get out and perform live again somehow. Which
Absolutely. I don't want to do anything political here, but the fact of the matter is a lot of states, including us, have opened up basically at the same time. Our numbers are declining because of the efforts that Pritzker has made and Mayor has made. You know, they really have made it clear to the people of Illinois to be smart. And I think they, in general, are. I mean, there's a lot of people walking out without masks. But if you look at the statistics, we're one of the lowest states around. And we got to be number one. You know, Chicago's number one. So we got to bring Illinois to number one. You know, and just keep your fingers crossed about the second wave. Hopefully we won't get hit.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think everybody just staying safe. Everybody keeping their masks on. I was just at the store this afternoon for a second in between meetings, and 99% of the people had masks on. No problem. Everybody's starting to get used to them, and that's the best way to stop the transmission
right.
of anything. So,
right.
you know, if you want to go and have dinner and you want to go hang out again and you want to have some sort of a normal summer at the beach, we've all got to just deal with this stuff because there's no way to get around it. A virus is a virus.
Amen.
And you don't want to get it. that's my motto. A virus is a virus and you don't want to get
it. Can I quote you on that? A virus is a virus.
Print it. Done. Print it. All right, Dave. Thanks for being on as usual. And we're going to announce next Friday's guest at some point. I would assume maybe on Monday or something.
Monday or Tuesday, I should have something for you.
Okay. All right. But next Friday, 6 p.m., right back here for Chicago Blues and Beyond. And, of course, on Monday, 6 p.m., we will be back here. We're going to announce all the shows over the weekend except for Friday. We're going to announce that on Monday or Tuesday. But check out, we've got a full slate of shows for next week. Of course, I don't have anything in front of me that tells me who's on, but I know Chris Anderson's going to be on from the Jazz Record Art Collective. He's coming on Tuesday, and we've got a whole lot of the Jazz Institute's going to be on Thursday.
Wow.
We're going to be talking all about their summer jazz camp and some of the virtual things they're doing there, and a whole lot more. So everybody stick around. Dave, thanks again for co-hosting here on Friday.
Thank you.
You get to hang around to listen to the theme music as I everyone.
I still got to come up with some for the blue show.
Well, we got this one. So, all right, everybody stay safe, cool. Stay healthy. And as I always say, if you like this show, like it, share it, leave us a message, shoot us a DM, tell your neighbors, tell the family, call the grandkids.